Guardado este guacueco. Tanya Dunga's Gigon, then on Zewa Dahusa Dache, Ungahuan, and Hadiwa Nodus, Nene Aboriginal Voices, Oscar Dewa Nyawar Oscar, Ne Jota FM, CFRC.
This is 7 p.m. Oh, look at that. Oh, I like that. We should have played that underneath there.
I can.
Go for it.
Okay.
Pull it down a bit so we can.
All right, you ready?
Go.
Try the 7 o'clock again.
It's 7 o'clock, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, and we're broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. Ethereal. Oh, my gosh. Continuation of Aboriginal Voices. Who's that?
That is the voice of Mimi.
Of oh, is it?
Yes.
Oh, she's part of our show.
Well, I just thought
this must make her feel good to be a part of the show. Identity.
White flowers. So that's a lovely way to start that show. Yeah. I think we might do that, invite Mimi to come by every second week or something.
Oh, yeah?
Wouldn't that be fun?
Sure.
And you could do the 7 o'clock, and she could do the undertones.
Yeah, the undertones.
Ooh, I like
we'll
that.
We'll call it that, the undertones.
All right. So what's the temperature outside?
Freezing.
No, it's getting colder.
It's so cold, Doug.
No, come on.
No?
It's somewhere around 17 or 18 degrees right now.
Yeah.
It was 23 when I came in at the parking lot.
Was it?
Yeah, I was really surprised that it was so warm. Then I realized, oh, yeah, it's all asphalt all around these buildings on the main campus.
Yeah, it is.
There's grass further down towards the lake, but out here in the parking lot where vehicles could park. Yeah. That's probably why it was nice and warm.
Like, I was always complaining about the heat.
Yes, and now?
I think maybe it wasn't so bad.
Hey.
Like, when it gets cold at night.
What? Mm-hmm. Keep
Douglas going. Has run his chair over the headphone.
Not over the headphones, come on.
No, the headphone where? The cans.
Go for it. I'm just getting settled. Come on, it's top of the hour.
Yeah, top of the hour. Shape up.
Okay.
All righty, Doug.
Yes.
Guess what? I don't know if I can tell you this, but I'm going to try.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can tell you. It's right here. The Quinney Arts Council Award recipient, Jennifer E. Brandt. There you go.
There you go.
She is a talented musician, artist, photographer.
Yes.
I've never known her to be a photographer.
Yes.
Educator, cultural advocate for Kootenai. That'd be the Tiendanega Mohawk Territory, deeply rooted in her indigenous identity. She shares her traditions and culture through teaching, music, and community and work. Anyways. Yada, yada, yada. She ended up winning an award.
That's good, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, like I'm trying to get to the award stuff.
Mm-hmm. And where was the award given out?
Oh, I don't know. Oh. Someplace in Belleville.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no, they haven't done it yet. It's the 25th.
Okay. That's
apparently
good.
You can join them to
ready.
See it. Like, you don't know her. But
I think you
well, not enough
I
to go to
think you
Palvo.
Introduced me to
I
her
did, yeah.
at the See, artist one, in the
I just talked to her, I says.
Yeah, that's yeah. right. So and it was her photography that she
no,
told me all about.
No, not photography. She paints, I think. Multimedia painting or something.
Okay. And I think she had photography.
Did she have some photography there too?
I'm pretty sure she did.
A lot of time has passed, Doug, since that whole thing.
We'll get that.
That was like pre-COVID.
We'll get that interview out and rebroadcast it.
We knew her when?
2 weeks from now.
Before she was like a famous award-winning artist. Says that she won the Arts Recognition Award. Quinney Arts Council.
Wow.
I don't know. I read something else where it actually told you the award. I don't know.
Oh, okay. That's good.
So she won an award. I mean, that in itself, it's cool. And they'll be giving it to her at Dinkle's Restaurant.
On the 26th of September.
Yeah, 25th of September, 11 till 2 at the Dinkle's downtown. Belleville.
In Belleville.
Yeah. Have you heard of it?
No. I'd have to go look it up.
Belleville?
No. The restaurant.
Oh, yeah. Anyways, so that's my little bit of news. Of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Something from home.
Something from home. I love it.
Something from the where I come from.
Yes. You're going to tell people
something
where
else
that
what
is?
Happened came down there in Deserana, the... big building fire.
Oh, I didn't hear about that.
Oh, you didn't hear about that?
No.
Big building fire.
Oh, no.
It's like the big building. I don't know what they called it.
Is this
flea market? It used to be a flea market.
Oh, okay.
Not a flea market anymore.
It's not the furniture making factory that was there, or the boat making factory.
No.
Okay.
Boat making factory?
Yeah, someone was making boats there at one time.
Oh, no, not there.
Oh, okay. Good.
Oh, the boat making factory thing was across the bay and Picton.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Hmm. I guess all the folks left.
Yeah. Mm. He doesn't even want to talk to us.
That's all right. Yeah. Well,
this is Jesse. Jesse. Can you hear us, Jesse?
Problem is, he's waving. Can't you
Jesse?
See him?
Yeah. Jesse, come back.
No.
We have questions.
No. Uh-oh. There you go. He's coming back for you.
No, he's not.
Yeah, he's going to sit in your chair.
No, not even.
Oh, we got an extra chair here.
He could come back if he wanted to. Oh, he did come back.
Hang on, just a sec. You keep talking. I'll go.
Come on in. So we have a question.
Oh, yeah.
You're like a football guy, right?
Yeah.
Like you play football?
No, I work with the team. No, I was recruited, but I worked.
To get close.
Oh.
Have you seen a microphone before?
I wasn't sure I was on the air.
Oh, yeah, we're on the air.
Yeah, we're
my
live.
Question is this.
Mm-hmm.
That football field
mm-hmm.
in Wisconsin where the Green Bay Packers play.
Lambeau.
Is it Lambeau? I thought it was named after that guy. The coach? Coach.
Lombardi. So they named the Super Bowl trophy after him, but the field is named Lambeau Field. And the team, Green Bay Packers, are actually the only publicly owned NFL sports team. All the season ticket holders have it's like a 0.1% share in the team.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah, pretty sweet. This is what I do. I can't offer much in the way of actual
information. What do you think of that football guy that won last year? The one that's marrying Taylor Swift.
Oh, well, I mean, he lost to my beloved Philadelphia Eagles, so they made the Super Bowl. Travis Kelce, he's a fantastic football player. He's been...
Apparently he's better than those other guys.
He's one of the best. His brother was on the Eagles and retired the year before, but, good luck to them. I think it's the first mixed intelligence marriage in human history because... I think if brain cells were dynamite,
both, right?
He couldn't blow his nose.
Good thing.
But
it's a good thing that they both have money.
Yeah, no kidding. That's true. Yeah, I guess you don't really, I mean, I think she should make him sign a prenup, because NFL money compared to Taylor Swift money is, I mean, it's the difference between me and Lord Alfred Bader, you know? Like, yeah. He's got castle money, I've got, a car payment to make. Any other questions I can
Only thing. In my mind, it was Lombardi Field.
I'm sure there is a Lombardi Field, but yeah, Lambeau.
So I was having an argument with Douglas here, thinking to myself, wait a minute, when did they change it?
I am actually curious, because yeah, like I think the Super Bowl trophy is enough plaudits for the man. He was a great coach, big proponent of the pulling guard, Forrest Gregg and the boys.
I don't know what that means.
Basically, the two biggest guys on the inside of your offensive line, the guys who block, are called guards. And they were the first team where they were like, rather than just have him go forward and smash into somebody, what if we pulled him around so we moved him outside and let him beat up on the smaller guys?
Oh, yeah.
And then
yeah.
He won all those Super Bowls because of it. Because if you're 100, and this is the days when like plumbers and cobblers were playing football. So yeah, if you're like 115 pounds and you've got a 300-pound pulling guard coming after you, yeah, not much you can do about it.
You run faster.
You run faster. On that note, I will return the captain's chair.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on,
that
guys.
That was awesome.
Thanks, Jesse.
My pleasure, guys. That was a good pick-me-up. I enjoyed it.
Good. Wow. What do you think, Sean? You got your answer tonight.
I know. Thank you.
From the source.
Thank you, Jesse. It's a guy that knows sports.
There you go.
Way more than I do.
You better start listening
both
to
of
his
us together,
show.
I think. Yeah.
I love it. Okay. Hey, how about Just Like a Ghost?
Sure.
Twin flames.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Go for it, Doug.
You were having fun with that, but...
I'm happy.
I thought... And then I've got a quick... a story that came to me as you guys were all talking. It's how the Bear...
I forgot to tell Jesse that I really only know football from Friday Night Lights.
All right.
I hope he's listening and gets a chuckle out of that.
This story after Twin Flames with Just Like a Ghost, Bear boasts to Chipmunk.
Okay.
Just a wild child searching for someone to hold. But you took
Long ago, Bear was out walking around. As he walked, Bear was boasting. "Huh," he said, "I am the strongest of all the animals." "Huh," he said, "I am the biggest of all the animals." "Huh," he said, "I can do anything because I am Bear. If I want anyone to do my bidding, I only have to tell them because I am Bear. I, Bear, can do anything." And just as Bear said that, a little voice down near the ground spoke up. It said, "You cannot do anything." Well, Bear looked down. There was Chipmunk sticking his head out of his hole. And Bear looked down at him and said, "I, Bear, can do anything I wish." And Chipmunk said, "If this is so, can you tell the sun not to come up in the morning?" Bear thought for a moment and said, "Yes, that I can do also. I, Bear, can tell the sun not to rise. In fact, tomorrow the sun will not come up."
"That is good," said Chipmunk. "I will stay and watch."
And the two sat down right there. The sun was just going down. And Bear and Chipmunk turned to face towards the east and wait for the sun to not come up the next morning. As they sat there through the night, Bear was chanting under his breath. He was saying, "The sun will not come up. The sun will not come up. I, Bear, command it. The sun will not come up." But sitting next to him, Chipmunk was chanting under his breath, "The sun is going to rise. The sun is going to rise. Bear will be foolish. The sun is going to rise." And as the night ended, a little bit of light began to appear there in the east. Bear began to chant louder, "The sun will not come up. The sun will not come up." And little Chipmunk next to him was saying, "The sun is going to rise. The sun is going to rise." And as Bear chanted as hard as he could and faced the direction of the sun, telling it not to come up, the sun lifted above the horizon. It was a new day, and the sun had come up. Chipmunk began to laugh. He rolled over and over with laughter. "Bear is a fool," he said. "Bear is so foolish. The sun came up. The sun came up. The sun came up." And as he said that, suddenly, whomp, a big paw came down on top of him. And Bear looked down as he held the chipmunk there on the ground, and he said, "Indeed, the sun did come up, but you will never see another sunrise." Chipmunk knew now how foolish he had been. He thought quick. He said, "Oh, Bear, you are right to kill me. I am a foolish little chipmunk. I am worthless, and I mean nothing in the world. You, Bear, are the greatest of all, and if only I could catch my breath because you're pushing down so hard, if only you would just lift your paw a little bit, I would tell you how wonderful you are before you kill me. So just lift your paw up a little bit so I can praise the great, the wonderful, the powerful Bear."
"Huh," Bear said, "that is a good idea."
And he lifted up his paw just a little bit, and Chipmunk scooted out and ran for his hole as fast as he could go. And just as he dove into it, Bear's big paw whipped out, and whoosh! Bear's claws scraped right down Chipmunk's back. But he got away into his hole. He stayed there all through the winter while those wounds on his back healed up. And when he came out in the spring, he now had stripes on his back. To this day, if you see Chipmunk, you will see those stripes, and it may remind you, as it reminds Chipmunk, be careful of who you make fun of. You may be the one who is foolish in the long run. And that is how that story of Chipmunk and Bear goes. Ho!
we go from here? The end is surely near. Where do you go, my dear, to mend your broken heart? Are you a slave, my friend? Are you the living dead? You can't change the world if you don't do your part. Respect the gift. Respect the gift. Respect the no love, it seems. We're all my human beings. Don't lose your mouth, it's deep, or you will lose your mind. They're gonna come for you like they always do. They're gonna summon you, bend the truth. What you gonna do? You gotta give it all you got.
Janice, we're looking at a program that you are running, or you're the director of a program at Western University. Can you tell us a little bit about that program and when you got started there?
Yeah, well, the program at Western has been around for quite a few years, actually. The genesis, the original kind of idea, actually emerged in the late 1980s and then 1990s, and then it was a program housed within anthropology, and then it became a standalone program in about 2012 or 2013. So we've been a standalone program, you know, for about 5 or 6 years now, 7 years. And recently, with the university's development and implementation of the Indigenous Strategic Plan, all of a sudden, and rightly so, First Nations Studies as a program became one of the areas of attention. So there's been a move at Western to move it from a standalone program to a department within the Faculty of Social Science where it's housed. And so I was originally in the Faculty of Health Sciences, so a completely different faculty. And the dean from social science came knocking on my door and asked if I'd be interested in coming over to First Nations Studies to help it transition to a department. And and I said yes, and I thought, what an exciting opportunity. So that's how I ended up here. I've been here for almost a year now, and it's been fantastic. The people here are great, a lot of energy. And so we're trying to figure out now, how do we move our program forward in the context of reconciliation? Because universities all across Canada now are, you know, making adjustments within their universities to to do more kind of in the area of Indigenous studies. And so we're still trying to figure that out a little bit, and we've got some pretty neat ideas that we're hoping to build on. And we are also growing. We're going through a hiring process right now, and trying to find, you know, the best candidates who can fit in the new space that we occupy. So that's kind of where we're at with the program, and I'm really excited about the future for it.
And how might people apply to be part of that program then? And as we're listening to you talk about it, may be of interest to students. How do they get involved?
Sure. Well, we've got a website that's part of Western's website. So if you go to the University of Western Ontario or Western University, and you search for First Nations Studies, and in there we've got an administrative team that can help students navigate their enrollment in the First Nations Studies program. So we've got some good people at the helm who can help students get registered if that is their interest. And we're moving more towards trying to help students become better researchers and collaborators with Indigenous people. So doing research with and for Indigenous people that is that has Indigenous issues and concerns at the center of that interest. So what we found through our environmental scan that we completed in the fall was that there are many programs in some departments that tend to offer like a broad range of classes, and we thought, you know what, instead of replicating, you know, what other people are doing, maybe what we could do is focus our attention on better research in development. So that's kind of where we're moving towards.
So that means that you're going to be teaching researching skills, and individuals could pick, say, their own home community as a focal point, and go back to the people in their community and ask permission to work on a special project, whether it's highlighting athletes in the group or individuals who have contributed to their community or to the broader community. Is that what you're looking at?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one of the ideas as well, and also teaching people how to be better allies in Indigenous research, and doing the kind of research that really matters, and helping them to learn the ways of thinking about Indigenous research and the tools that seem to work really well that go along with that. So in a nutshell, yes. That is, you know, one of the ways that we're thinking about the program.
So this takes me now to thinking about how you got there. What brought you to university as a young person to say, I want to go to university and I can do this?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I don't often get to talk about my story. And I guess, you know, in a way it sounds really typical. And in some ways it is not typical. So I was an athlete in high school, and I think it's fair to say I was not a good student for many years. And I mean, it's funny because it's not funny. My father just recently passed away, and so I was looking over all of the you know, the things that my parents had kept, because my mother had passed away several years ago. And some of the things that they kept were my report cards, and I can see why they buried them. You know, I think I thought I was probably a better student than I was, and I really struggled in high school. I can see that from the report cards, and there are some real reasons for that. Growing up in Timmins was I grew up in Timmins, Ontario, for the most part, and it was really hard to see opportunities for someone who's Indigenous and female, and so I think at times I probably gave up on education. My parents didn't have a high level of education either, so I think they were just happy to have me finish high school. So I gravitated towards sports, and I was a really good athlete in high school. And I think just by hook or crook, you know, I got into a university, came to Western because that seemed to be a lot of where a lot of the students from my high school went, and it was sort of the same pattern in university. I wasn't a great student in my undergraduate years, but I was a very good athlete. And near the end of my university career, I just, you know, I realized there's so much more here And a really good friend of mine actually also said to me, just, you know, if you put half as much energy into school as you did into athletics, you could actually be a really good student. And so I did. You know, I transferred that energy over into schooling, into education, and you know, and she was right, and I found a passion. So when I finished my history degree, because I came through Western in history, you know, I was trying to think, what do I want to do? Because, like, what do you do with an undergraduate history degree? And at that time, and I think it's probably still, you know, a lot of people think, well, you go into teaching. And I didn't really want to be a teacher, and I don't think I was really ready to leave university yet, because I wasn't satisfied with how I had done, and I don't think I had reached my potential. So I stayed, and I was literally walking the halls one day, and happened to go by this door that said the International Center for Olympic Studies, and it's the door that I always used to pass on my way to badminton practice, because I was on the badminton team here at Western. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to open this door and just see where it takes me. And I opened up the door, and there was this big man, really, really big, big like a bear, sitting behind this desk that looked like 18. It was 18 feet long. It was one of those really impressive kind of rooms, and the walls were like this deep burgundy red, and, you know, they had like velvet curtains, and it was impressive. And and I think he said something like, come in, my dear child, sit down. And and so I did, and that begins my graduate career. And it was during my graduate studies where I thought, how do I marry my two passions, my love for history, and you know, wanting to write a different sort of history, one that wasn't didn't repeat, you know, the colonizing ways of thinking, and how do I marry sport, like how do I merge sport into that? So I, you know, wandered into that area, and at that time, you know, sport history, sport studies was just a fledgling field, and you know, found some really good mentors who really helped me along, and then just kind of found my way through it. So that's how I ended up in this position here. Really a lot of luck, tenacity, some really good guidance, great mentors, and a lot of hard learning, I have to admit.
Mm-hmm. And all the way through that, you left out the fact that you stayed in athletics. So you did badminton. What other athletic adventures did you have?
Yeah, well, I did badminton as well as cross country and track and field. So I was a three varsity athlete, and it was really tough. I remember during my undergraduate years, rolling off the bus from cross country, we'd be coming in from the United States or some big meet somewhere, because we were really a really good team, and so we'd always, you know, we'd be competing against NCAA athletes, and I'd be rolling off the bus at maybe 3 or 4 a.m., and then I'd be, you know, basically heading right over to the badminton court, because there was no point in going, you know, to my home or residence, and just starting to warm up for badminton, because the competitions would start at like 8 a.m. So, they were really tough days, but they also kept me grounded in the sense of, you know, I was still uncertain about myself as a student, and this helped to give me, I think, a sense of identity, a sense of belonging, a sense of accomplishment, when I wasn't feeling necessarily those things in education yet, because I didn't know well enough, and I didn't feel those things in education, but I knew enough to know that I wanted to stay and that I could become something. So it was me going through this really tough transition, and this not even a balancing act, but just trying to figure out how to find my way in a world where I didn't really know how to find my way. So it's a really complicated space that a lot of people don't talk about, you know, that gets glossed over in discussions about sport. And I think my story in that way kind of helps to flesh that out. And it's, so in a way, that's why I say it's typical, because it's very easy to just kind of talk about my story as, well, sport was a hook to get her into education. No, it's a lot more complicated than that. So
I know from doing some sports, especially running, for example, or cross-country skiing in my case, but once you're out in the woods, or you're out on a trail somewhere, it gives you time to think as well as exercise. So you're thinking about your how everything fits in and with your theme or whatever your study is, and also your passion.
Yeah, and for me, I think there wasn't even that much time to think as an elite athlete. So through the years, I've actually come to kind of pick apart, you know, my love for running, and I've come to realize that I didn't really like competition so much. It really was just a way for me to stay engaged in school. I've come back to running. I quit for a couple of years, and I've come back to running, and I think it's more along the lines of what you're talking about now, where I'm very passionate about it, but it's not the competitive kind of running. So I love going out and running in the woods, and there's plenty of trails like in and around London, and that then becomes the space for me to just think and get grounded and center myself, and you know, and to let go of things that I need to let go of, and also just to be healthy. But it's more of a real kind of personal experience for me now, as opposed to trying to be better. So I, you know, to run a faster time or, you know, to win the next competition. In the end, that became quite meaningless for me. Mm-hmm. Running has become something different than what I used to do in my competitive years.
So you're a role model for young people now who are looking at you, especially young university students. But then do you see yourself as a role model for high school students as well, or elementary school?
Being a role model, you know what? That's a really tough one, because I know there is a real tendency to see athletes as role models. And on the one hand, I say, you know what, I don't see myself as a role model, because I think role models are, like, you should know them as a person. So I think maybe people, you know, based on stories that they hear, you know, maybe they either come to appreciate or not, you know, some of the things that I've achieved or some of the things that I've worked through. And in that sense, if that's a role model, okay, I get it. But I don't, I don't wear that kind of, expression or label, if you will, lightly, because I don't necessarily see myself as a role model. You know, I prefer to see myself as just someone who's had, you know, experiences that might be similar to or different from other people. And if, you know, people want to talk to me about that, then I'm certainly open and willing to do that, as long as I know they're going to respect my story. Because mm-hmm. A lot of people just don't understand, you know, how to understand, you know, my story. So I tend to see it a little bit differently, and I kind of cringe a little bit when I hear the word role model, even though I know it's used very often, you know, in the education sector and in the sports sector.
Well, I watched when you were here at Queen's University, and you were talking to a room, an absolutely packed room of students in it. In fact, they were across disciplines here at Queen's. But when I watched and listened to you, you engaged them in your presentation, and I was surprised to see how many of the students put their cell phone down or their tablets down and just listened to you. And following that, I also watched how you interacted with students, and you are a role model, and you just keep going the way you're going, because for a lot of them, a lot of people in that theater, afterwards, I was able to talk with a few and ask about their thoughts following it. And a few of those students have gone off to find out more about Aboriginal athletes in their community. So you're sparking people to do things, and as a role model, athletics helps.
Well, that's great. Well, that's really good to hear.
Mm-hmm. And thinking about your time when you looked into, I know you have a number of books and papers out that look into Aboriginal athletes from Canada who were in the Olympics. And did you want to talk at all about that today?
Sure, I'd love to talk about that, and also recognizing that a friend and colleague of mine, Christine O'Bonslin at the University of Victoria, also works in this area. And I mean, I certainly look to Christine as a leader in this area, but it's certainly nice to be to be held up kind of alongside her in that respect. And there aren't many people kind of working in this area, so it's really nice to have these conversations.
Okay. So the first question that I was asked when I brought this up in a small group was, when were women included in, Aboriginal women were included in the Olympics, But then were they really counting whether you were an Aboriginal woman or just an athlete from Canada?
Yeah, you know, and that's a, you know what, that is a great question, because women have always been part of the Olympic Games, right from, well, not so much in 1896. There's debates about when the first modern Olympic Games were held, the Summer Olympic Games, and there's debates about whether or not they were actually involved in that. And there wouldn't have been many. I think we're talking about one or two. But we certainly did start to see women involved in, you know, 1900. But they weren't formally involved in the Olympic Games in the sense that there were no real official events for women on the Olympic program. They were always held as kind of novelty events, if you will. So they weren't part of the official Olympic program, even though when you read like general histories of the Olympic Games, no one makes that distinction. They just talk about, you know, women's involvement in the Olympic Games. We don't formally see women on the Olympic program until the late 1920s, and really until 1928. And even then, when they were formally put on the program in events like track and field, for instance, men were aghast at the women competing because they were exerting themselves in a way that, you know, people thought was inappropriate. And they made up all sorts of, you know, they came up with all sorts of reasons about why they shouldn't be involved in the games, you know, from them looking ugly, not appealing, you know, to the sensibilities of men, from hurting themselves biologically, that somehow they wouldn't be able to reproduce, you know, if they exerted themselves like that. So we see women involved, typically in female or feminine, what we would call feminine appropriate sports, sports that enhance their femininity, but they were always never really allowed to exert themselves all that much. And when they did start to do that in 1928, people were just, men especially, got into an uproar. What I find really interesting, if we talk about the Olympics from an Indigenous point of view, is we see a long history of male involvement, male Indigenous involvement in the Olympic Games, you know, right from the earliest days, like 1900 onwards. And there is actually a long list of male Indigenous Olympians. We don't really see female Indigenous Olympians until after World War II. And, you know, your question brings to mind another question that I would ask is, why not? Why didn't we see Indigenous women, you know, involved in the Olympics at earlier ages? So clearly, or at earlier stages, because clearly they were involved. And, you know, and they were coming from the reserves and sometimes from the cities. But where were the women? So, and we don't know that history because there hasn't been any attention paid to it. So if there's anybody out there who is looking for a great research project, that would be a critical question to ask. So that's a really great question that you ask. And the point is, we don't really know why they weren't involved prior to World War II. They just aren't.
If you look at the social issues for people who lived on reserve, it wasn't until 1951 that the pass system was officially disbanded. Mm-hmm. And to be an athlete, you would have to request from the Indian agent a pass to leave your reserve to go to participate. And maybe that was part of the reason up until after the war.
I mean, it may have been, but then, you know, we have to ask a couple of questions if because of that. So one, how come it is that men were allowed to leave the community and not women if women wanted to participate? And secondly, in the research that I've done and that especially Christine Obonsawin has done, and we've asked other colleagues who have researched on the history of the PASS system, and as far as we can tell, there is no evidence to suggest that athletes actually needed a PASS. And so we wonder then, were athletes treated differently when it came to the PASS system? And one of the things that we might think about is, well, maybe they were treated differently because they were doing something that was considered appropriate by dominant society, because they were getting involved in a sporting activity that people understood, an activity that was contributing to, you know, ideas about, you know, the British imperialism. So they were competing for, you know, the empire, mm-hmm. so to speak, and then for Canada, and not so much for their own, you know, identities, for their own communities. And so they were doing something that the settlers would have appreciated as being assimilatory, as being part of assimilation. So perhaps they didn't need a pass system because of that. So there's no evidence to suggest right now that they actually needed a pass. And if anybody ever comes up with evidence that they actually did, that would be something to write about, because it is definitely worth talking about. So how is it that some people needed a pass and other people didn't? And did this have to do with what they wanted to do when they got the pass, mm-hmm. and whether or not what they wanted to do was contributing to their, or at least thought to be contributing towards their assimilation?
Now, I hope some of the students who are in the First Nations Studies program at Western University are listening to you, because there are four projects right there that I can think of. And
absolutely.
Yeah. I'm interested, too, in what's happened in the last few years with the Olympics, because there's been much more of a focus, certainly in the last two Olympics, much more focus on Aboriginal athletes. And I'm wondering if that's because of the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, the impact of that starting to make changes, and then the TRC with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Do you think that we're seeing something that's worthwhile, where people are recognizing and celebrating Aboriginal athletes from across the country playing in all of the sports?
I think, yeah, there's probably a number of things going on here. And again, this is another area worth exploring. So, you know, again, this conversation really highlights how Indigenous sports studies is an emerging area that really needs a lot of attention, not just because it's about celebration, but because it points to really important patterns in, Indigenous and settler relations within the country. So, you know, when you ask that question, a number of things come up. One, I think there are, we're in a time where more and more people are identifying as Indigenous. And so I think what we're seeing is more people now identifying than ever before as being Indigenous. So there's part of me that thinks there may be more Indigenous athletes who have competed for Canada than, you know, the list that I have, which I think is fairly comprehensive, and I don't have it with me, so I couldn't just, like, go through the list. Mm-hmm. But there's probably more people who are on that list who just didn't identify as Indigenous, and maybe because they, enfranchised, or, maybe they just didn't want to. Secondly, I think there are more... there's more recognition now just of needing to create opportunities.
But you mean positive recognition, right?
Positive recognition,
right.
For sure.
Okay.
And I think this is also supported with the emergence of the Indigenous sports system, because, you know, the Aboriginal sports circle with its regional sport bodies, they've been around now since the 1990s, and I think we're starting to see, the outcomes of that system, because some of these athletes have also had opportunities through that Indigenous sports system. So it's because of Indigenous leaders who have really fought for opportunities in Indigenous sport that have provided some of these athletes with opportunities as a stepping stone to get to higher levels of competition. And of course, there is just more awareness, as you say, and more efforts to recognize Indigenous athletes within those systems, wherever it is that they're coming from. One of the things that we don't do well enough, though, because we tend to homogenize the athletes, and I think there are a number of assumptions that people make when they celebrate Indigenous athletes, and one of the big assumptions is that, you know, they came from an impoverished background. We don't make a distinction between athletes who didn't have opportunities and who didn't have the money to get involved and stay involved in sport, because we all know that getting to the Olympics is an incredibly expensive commitment, and athletes who are excellent, and there are a lot of them, but who just don't have, you know, the economic opportunity to make that kind of commitment. So when we're celebrating athletes, we tend to celebrate kind of this homogenous group of people, and which, you know, on the one hand, I fully appreciate and I recognize why this is important. But as we move forward, you know, if we're going to create more opportunities for Indigenous athletes, we need to start looking economically at the basis of Indigenous sport, how it's being funded, where these athletes are coming from, so that we can more clearly identify where the holes are. Because I think what we'll find is a lot of these athletes, you know, are coming from urban centers, maybe even like major urban centers or places that live near urban centers, or if they don't, you know, they've made a financial commitment to move into the city and to keep on with this sport.
And I'm thinking too, as you're saying all these, my brain's wandering all over the place. You're making me think about it. I hope the listeners do too. I just want to remind listeners that I'm talking with Dr. Janice Forsyth and Director of First Nations Studies at Western University. And Janice, my last question I think that I should probably give you right now, because you were saying that you only had half an hour and we're almost there. But I'll give you as much time as you need here, because it's a very important question or a very important issue to look at this. One is, where can people find research materials that you've been involved in? And you mentioned
Christine
Obamswan, yeah, as well, and she's at the University of Victoria. You've also written some books and articles on this. So, and what direction should young people who are you know, 13, 14, who are sort of wondering what should I do, whether they're in big cities or smaller communities outside of those big cities, and what could they be doing? There's all kinds of things like nutrition to talk about. There's you know, proper exercises that would keep your body moving correctly and not straining parts of it, all of that anatomy and physiology that you have to study. But also there's the psychological one that goes with, am I doing something worthwhile for me and not because everybody says I have to?
Yeah, you know, it's really fun when young people get involved in research, and it is totally possible, you know, to do that if they have, you know, a little bit of good guidance. So, you know, I've seen some pretty neat stuff come forward where young people have gotten together and they do their own kind of needs assessment, you know, from a young person's point of view. And they could do a needs assessment in terms of what they would like to see and do, and what the barriers are that are holding them back from being more physically active wherever it is that they come from, you know, whether it's in urban centers or, you know, remote communities. Young people actually have really good insight, and it's a fun thing to do if you can do a needs assessment. So you can always Google, like online, right? Get on the computer and go to Google and then do like needs assessment, you know, for youth or something, and they could organize their own research projects and carry it out and present it to, you know, if they live on a reserve, like the Bayonne Council or other decision makers, maybe their school, and or if they live in the city, especially with the TRC nowadays, you know, I'm hoping, you know, city councilors, decision makers are more likely to listen to what it is that they have to say, because they are important voices that need to be heard. So I think that is definitely one thing if they want to make that kind of change. And the other thing, you know, if I think back on my own life and, you know, things that I hear in a lot of the interviews that I've done with, you know, many different people over the years about their experiences in sport, is just keep at it. You know, find a way, find what works for you, and make it meaningful. Find a way to make it a part of your life, whatever it is, and you probably can't go wrong with that.
Well, Janice Forsyth, thank you very much for being part of Aboriginal Voices here at CFRC, and I do appreciate all you've said today.
Yeah, thanks, Douglas. I really appreciate the time.
And Jimmy Gwetch.
Migwetch.
Hey there, Kingston. Looking for the latest in arts and culture? Join me, Ellie Stern, Friday 3 to 4 p.m. for the Kingston Curator. Featuring interviews with artists themselves, I'll explore what's happening around town. From live music and theater to gallery shows, festivals, and more. Catch it live on CFRC 101.9 FM, stream at cfrc.ca, or listen anytime on the CFRC Podcast Network. The Kingston Curator, your backstage pass to Kingston's creative scene.
Quilt is a literary publication for and by undergraduate students here at Queen's. We are open for submissions of creative and academic writing for our upcoming themed volume, Abundance. All subjects and styles are welcome, so long as they align with our theme, and we welcome creative and wide interpretation of that theme. Submissions should be short, sweet, and, as always, brilliant. To learn more, to read our past volumes, and to submit, head to our Instagram at QUQuilt. We can't wait to read your work. Love, Quilt.
Next chapter in one of Canada's longest sports rivalries will be written on Saturday, September 13th. The Queen's Gaels travel to Toronto to reconnect with their old four foes. It's a clash 5 decades in the making, as the last Varsity Blues victory came on October 12, 1975. Can Queens continue their golden rule over the Varsity Blues, or will Toronto shock the world once more with another stunning underdog victory? Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM at 3:45 p.m. for the Grad Club pregame show, ahead of the scheduled 4 p.m. kickoff.
My name is Stephen Brooks. I'm an emergency doctor and researcher in the Faculty of Health Sciences at Queen's University. Out-of-hospital cardiac arrest affects about 35,000 people across Canada every year. The sooner treatment begins, the higher the probability of recovery. Neighbours Saving Neighbours is a pilot program to improve survival for people who experience sudden cardiac arrest in Frontenac County. Let us teach you how to do CPR, use an AED, and become a lifesaver. Consider becoming a Neighbours Saving Neighbours volunteer.
Apply today at frontenacparamedics.ca.
What's going on? Just the work, Michael. Tanya Dunas Gigo, then on the what I'm Sadache, Unguahuan, Hadi Wanodos, Nene Aboriginal Voices, Oscar Dewa Nyawa Oscar, Ne Jota FM, CFRC.
The world beats.
These are the sounds that keep it spinning.
The continuing story of today's global music.
Welcome to World Beat Canada.
I live on a hillside in East Vancouver. At its base is an unremarkable waterway called Still Creek. Every evening before sunset, Still Creek